So he had sent her away with a piece of real detective drudgery to keep her busy and out of sight. And I had been dragged with her because Deb wanted me along. Possibly she wanted to see if my fantastic ESP powers could help determine what these office sheep had eaten for breakfast. One look at this young gentleman's complexion, and I was fairly sure he had eaten cold pizza, potato chips, and a liter of Pepsi. It had ruined his complexion and given him an air of vacuous hostility. Still, I followed along as Mr. Grumpy directed Deborah to a conference room at the back of the building. There was a long oak table with 10 black high-backed chairs in the center of the room, and a desk in the corner with a computer and some audiovisual equipment. As Deb and her pimply young friend sat and began trading frowns, I wandered over to the desk. A small bookshelf sat under the window beside the desk. I looked out the window. Almost directly below me, I could see the growing crowd of reporters and squad cars that now surrounded the door where we had gone in with Staban. I looked at the bookshelf, thinking I would clear a small space and lean there, tastefully away from the conversation. There was a stack of manila folders, and perched on top of it was a small gray object. It was squarish and looked to be plastic. A black wire ran from the thing over to the back of the computer. I picked it up to move it.
"Hey!"
the surly geek said.
"Don't mess with the webcam!"
I looked at Deb. She looked at me, and I swear I saw her nostrils flare like a racehorse at the starting gate. "The what?" she said quietly.
"I had it focused down on the entrance," he said. "Now I gotta refocus it. Man, why do you have to mess with my stuff?"
"He said webcam," I said to Deborah. "A camera," she said to me. "Yes." She turned to young Prince Charming. "Is it on?" He gaped at her, still concentrating on maintaining his righteous frown.
"What?"
"The camera," Deborah said. "Does it work?" He snorted and then wiped his nose with a finger.
"What do you think? I would get all worked up if it didn't? $200. It totally works."
I looked out the window where the camera had been pointing as he droned on in his surly grumble.
"I got a website and everything, cathouse.com. People can watch the team when they get here and when they leave."
Deborah drifted over and stood beside me, looking out the window. "It was pointed at the door," I said.
"Duh," our happy pal said. "How else are people on my website going to see the team?"
Deborah turned and looked at him. After about 5 seconds, he blushed and dropped his eyes to the table.
"Was the camera turned on last night?" she said.
He didn't look up, just mumbled,
"Sure, I mean, I guess so."
Deborah turned to me. Her computer knowledge was confined to knowing enough to fill out standardized traffic reports. She knew I was a little more savvy. "How do you have it set up?" I asked the top of the young man's head. "Do the images automatically archive?" This time he looked up. I had used archive as a verb, so I must be okay.
"Yeah," he said. "It refreshes every 15 seconds and just dumps to the hard drive. I usually erase in the morning."
Deborah actually clutched my arm hard enough to break the skin.
"Did you erase this morning?" she asked him.
He glanced away again.
"No," he said. "You guys came stomping in and yelling and stuff. I didn't even get to check my email."
Deborah looked at me. "Bingo," I said.
"Come here," she said to our unhappy camper.
"Huh?"
he said.
"Come here," she repeated.
And he stood up slowly, mouth hanging open, and rubbed his knuckles.
"What?"
he said.
"Could you please come over here, sir?"
Deborah ordered, with truly veteran cop technique, and he stuttered into motion and came over.
"Can we see the pictures from last night, please?"
He gaped at the computer and then at her.
"Why?"
he said. "Ah, the mysteries of human intelligence."
"Because,"
Deborah said very slowly and carefully, "I think you might have taken a picture of the killer." He stared at her and blinked, then blushed.
"No way," he said.
"Way," I told him. He stared at me and then at Deb, his jaw hanging open.
"Awesome," he breathed. "No shit? I mean, no, really? I mean..."
He blushed even harder. "Can we look at the pictures?" Deb said. He stood still for a second, then plunged into the chair at the desk and touched the mouse. Immediately, the screen came to life, and he began typing and mouse-clicking furiously.
"What time should I start?"
"What time did everybody leave?" Deborah asked him. He shrugged. "We were empty last night. Everybody gone by, what, 8 o'clock? "Start at midnight," I said, and he nodded.
"'Kay," he said.
He worked quietly for a moment, then,
"Come on," he mumbled. "It's only like a 600 megahertz, he said. "They won't update. They keep saying it's fine, but so freaking slow, and it won't..."
"Okay," he said, breaking off suddenly. A dark image appeared on the monitor. The empty parking lot below us.
"Midnight,"
he said, and stared at the screen. After 15 seconds, the picture changed to the same picture.
"Do we have to watch 5 hours of this?" Deborah asked.
"Scroll through," I said. "Look for headlights or something moving."
"Right," he said.
He did some rapid point-and-click, and the pictures began to flip past at 1 per second. They didn't change much at first. The same dark parking lot, one bright light out at the edge of the picture. After about 50 frames had clicked past, an image jumped into view.
"A truck,"
Deborah said. Our pet nerd shook his head.
"Security," he said,
and in the next frame the security car was visible. He kept scrolling, and the pictures rolled by, eternal and unchanging. Every 30 or 40 frames we would see the security truck pass, and then nothing. After several minutes of this, the pattern stopped, and there was a long stretch of nothing.
"Busted," my greasy new friend said.
Deborah gave him a hard look.
"The camera's broken?"
He looked up at her, blushed again, and looked away.
"The security dudes," he explained. "They totally suck. Every night at like 3, they park over at the other side and go to sleep."
He nodded at the unchanging pictures scrolling past.
"See? Hello, Mr. Security Dude? Hard at work?"
He made a wet sound deep in his nose that I had to assume was meant to be laughter.
"Not very."
He repeated the snorting sound and started the pictures scrolling again. And then suddenly,
"Wait,"
I called out. On screen, a van popped into view at the door below us. There was another pop as the image changed and a man stood beside the truck.
"Can you make it go closer?" Deborah asked.
"Zoom in," I said, before he could do more than frown a little. He moved the cursor, highlighted the dark figure on the screen, and clicked the mouse. The picture jumped to a closer look.
"You're not gonna get much more resolution," he said. "The pixels..."
"Shut up," said Deborah. She was staring at the screen hard enough to melt it, and as I stared too, I could see why. It was dark, and the man was still too far away to be certain, but from the few details I could make out, there was something oddly familiar about him, the way he stood frozen in the image on the computer, his weight balanced on both feet, and the overall impression of the profile. Somehow, as vague as it was, it added up to something. And as a very loud wave of sibilant chuckling erupted from deep in the back seat of my brain, it fell on me with the impact of a concert grand piano that, actually, he looked an awful lot like...
"Dexter?" Deborah said in a sort of hushed and strangled croak.
"Yes, indeed. Just like Dexter."
Chapter 23. I am pretty sure that Deborah took young Mr. Bad Hair Day back to the lounge, because when I looked up again, she was standing in front of me, alone. In spite of her blue uniform, she did not look at all like a cop right now. She looked worried, like she couldn't decide whether to yell or to cry, like a mommy whose special little boy had let her down in a big way.
"Well?"
she demanded, and I had to agree that she had a point.
"Not terribly," I said.
"You?" She kicked a chair. It fell over.
"God damn it, Dexter! Don't give me that clever shit! Tell me something! Tell me that wasn't you!"
I didn't say anything.
"Well, then tell me it is you! Just tell me something! Anything at all!"
I shook my head. There was really nothing to say, so I just shook my head again. "I'm pretty sure it isn't me," I said. "I mean, I don't think so." Even to me that sounded like I had both feet firmly planted in the land of lame answers.
What does that mean, pretty sure? Deb demanded. Does that mean you're not sure that it might be you in that picture?
Well, I said, a truly brilliant riposte, considering. Maybe. I don't know.
And does I don't know mean you don't know whether you're going to tell me, or does it mean that you really don't know if that's you in the picture?
I'm pretty sure it isn't me, Deborah, I repeated. But I really don't know for sure. It looks like me, doesn't it?
Shit,
she said, and kicked the chair where it lay. It slammed into the table.
How can you not know, goddammit?
It is a little tough to explain.
Try!
I opened my mouth, but for once in my life nothing came out. As if everything else wasn't bad enough, I seemed to be all out of clever, too.
I've been having these dreams, but...
Deb, I really don't know, I said, and I may have actually mumbled it.
Shit, 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 said Deborah.
Kick, kick, kick. And it was very hard to disagree with her analysis of the situation. All my stupid, self-mutilating musings swam back at me with a bright and mocking edge.
Of course it wasn't me. How could it be me? Wouldn't I know if it was me?
Apparently not, dear boy. Apparently you didn't actually know anything at all, because our deep, dark, dim little brains tell us all kinds of things that swim in and out of reality, but pictures do not lie. Deb unleashed a new volley of savage attacks on the chair and then straightened up. Her face was flushed, very red, and her eyes looked more like Harry's eyes than they ever had before.
All right, she said. It's like this.
And she blinked and paused for a moment as it occurred to both of us that she had just said a Harry thing. And for a second, Harry was there in the room between me and Deborah, the two of us so very different, and yet still both Harry's kids, the two strange fists of his unique legacy. Some of the steel went out of Deb's back, and she looked human, a thing I hadn't seen for a while. She stared at me for a long moment and then turned away. "You're my brother, Dex," she said. I was very sure that was not what she had originally intended to say. "No one will blame you," I told her.
"God damn you, you're my brother!"
she snarled. And the ferocity of it took me completely by surprise.
"I don't know what went on with you and Dad, the stuff you two never talked about. But I know what he would have done."
"Turned me in," I said, and Deborah nodded. Something glittered in the corner of her eye. "You're all the family I have, Dex. Not such a great bargain for you, is it?" She turned to me, and I could see tears in both eyes now. For a long moment, she just looked at me. I watched the tear run from her left eye and roll down her cheek. She wiped it, straightened up, and took a deep breath, turning away to the window once again.
"That's right," she said. "He would have turned you in, which is what I am going to do."
She looked away from me out the window, far out to the horizon.
"I have to finish these interviews," she said. "I'm leaving you in charge of determining if this evidence is relevant. Take it to your computer at home and figure out whatever you have to figure out. And when I am done here, before I go back out on duty, I am coming to get it, to hear what you have to say."
She glanced at her watch.
8 o'clock.
"And if I have to take you in then, I will." She looked back at me for a very long moment.
"God damn it, Dexter," she said softly,
and she left the room. I moved over to the window and had a look for myself. Below me, the circus of cops and reporters and gawking geeks was swirling, unchanged. Far away, beyond the parking lot, I could see the expressway, filled with cars and trucks blasting along at the Miami speed limit of 95 miles per hour. And beyond that in the dim distance was the high-rise skyline of Miami. And here in the foreground stood dim, dazed Dexter, staring out the window at a city that did not speak and would not have told him anything, even if it did.
God damn it, Dexter.
I don't know how long I stared out the window, but it eventually occurred to me that there were no answers out there.
There might be some, though, on Captain Pimple's computer. I turned to the desk. The machine had a CDRW drive. In the top drawer, I found a box of recordable CDs. I put one into the drive, copied the entire file of pictures, and took the CD out. I held it, glanced at it. It didn't have much to say, and I probably imagined the faint chuckling I thought I heard from the dark voice in the back seat. But just to be safe, I wiped the file from the hard drive. On my way out, the Broward cops on duty didn't stop me or even speak, but it did seem to me that they looked at me with a very hard and suspicious indifference. I wondered if this was what it felt like to have a conscience. I supposed I would never really know. Unlike poor Deborah, being torn apart by far too many loyalties that could not possibly live together in the same brain, I admired her solution, leaving me in charge of determining if the evidence was relevant. Very neat. It had a very hairy feel to it, like leaving a loaded gun on the table in front of a guilty friend and walking away, knowing that guilt would pull the trigger and save the city the cost of a trial. In Harry's world, a man's conscience couldn't live with that kind of shame. But as Harry had known very well, his world was long dead, and I did not have any conscience, shame, or guilt. All I had was a CD with a few pictures on it, and of course those pictures made even less sense than a conscience. There had to be some explanation that did not involve Dexter driving a truck around Miami in his sleep. Of course, most of the drivers on the road seemed to manage it, but they were at least partially awake when they started out, weren't they? And here I was, all bright-eyed and cheerfully alert, and not at all the kind of guy who would ever prowl the city and kill unconsciously. No, I was the kind of guy who wanted to be awake for every moment of it. And to get right down to the bottom line, there was the night on the causeway. It was physically impossible that I could have thrown the head at my own car, wasn't it? Unless I had made myself believe that I could be in two places at once, which made a great deal of sense, considering that the only alternative I could come up with was believing that I only thought I had been sitting there in my car watching someone else throw the head, when in fact I had actually thrown the head at my own car, and then... No. Ridiculous. I could not ask the last few shreds of my brain to believe in this kind of fairy tale. There would be some very simple, logical explanation, and I would find it. And even though I sounded like a man trying to convince himself that there was nothing under the bed, I said it out loud. "There is a simple, logical explanation," I said to myself. "And because you never know who else is listening," I added, "and there is nothing under the bed." But once again, the only reply was a very meaningful silence from the dark passenger. In spite of the usual cheerful bloodlust of the other drivers, I found no answers on the drive home. Or, to be perfectly truthful, I found no answers that made sense. There were plenty of stupid answers, but they all revolved around the same central premise, which was that all was not well inside the skull of our favorite monster, and I found this very hard to accept. Perhaps it was only that I did not feel any crazier than I had ever felt. I did not notice any missing gray tissue. I did not seem to be thinking any slower or more strangely, and so far I'd had no conversations with invisible buddies that I was aware of. Except in my sleep, of course. And did that really count? Weren't we all crazy in our sleep? What was sleep, after all, but the process by which we dumped our insanity into a dark subconscious pit and came out on the other side ready to eat cereal instead of the neighbor's children? And aside from the dreams I'd had, everything made sense. Someone else had thrown the head at me on the causeway, left a Barbie in my apartment, and arranged the bodies in intriguing ways. Someone else, not me. Someone other than dear dark Dexter. And that someone else was finally captured right here in the pictures on this CD. And I would look at the pictures and prove once and for all that it looked very much like the killer might be me? Good, Dexter. Very good. I told you there was a logical explanation. Someone else who was actually me. Of course.
That made wonderful sense, didn't it?
I got home and peeked into my apartment carefully. There did not appear to be anyone waiting for me. There was no reason why there should have been, of course, but knowing that this arch-fiend, who was terrorizing the metropolis, knew where I lived, was a little unsettling. He had proven he was the kind of monster who might do anything. He could even come in and leave more doll parts at any time, especially if he was me. Which, of course, he was not, certainly not. The pictures would show some small something to prove that the resemblance was only coincidental. And the fact that I was so strangely attuned to the murders was also coincidental, no doubt. Yes, this was clearly a series of perfectly logical, monstrous coincidences. Perhaps I should call the Guinness Book people. I wondered what the world record was for not being sure whether you committed a string of murders. I put on a Philip Glass CD and sat in my chair. The music stirred the emptiness inside me, and after a few minutes, something like my usual calm and icy logic returned. I went to my computer and turned it on. I put the CD into the drive and looked at the pictures. I zoomed in and out and did everything I knew how to do in an attempt to clean up the images. I tried things I had only heard about, and things that I made up on the spot, and nothing worked. At the end, I was no further along than I had been when I started. It was just not possible to get enough resolution to make the face of the man in the picture come clear. Still, I stared at the pictures. I moved them around to different angles. I printed them out and held them up to the light. I did everything a normal person would do, and while I was pleased with my imitation, I did not discover anything, except that the man in the picture looked like me. I just could not get a clear impression of anything, even his clothing. He wore a shirt that could have been white, or tan, or yellow, or even light blue. The parking lot light that shone on him was one of the bright argon anti-crime lights, and it cast a pinkish-orange glow. Between that and the lack of resolution in the picture, it was impossible to tell any more. His pants were long, loosely cut, light-colored. Altogether a standard outfit that anyone might have worn, including me. I had clothing just like it several times over, enough to outfit an entire platoon of Dexter lookalikes. I did manage to zoom in on the side of the truck enough to make out the letter A, and below it a B, followed by an R and either a C or an O, but the truck was angled away from the camera and that was all I could see. None of the other pictures offered me any hints. I watched the sequence again. The man vanished, reappeared, and then the van was gone. No good angles, no fortuitous accidental glimpses of his license plate, and no reason to say with any authority that either it was or was not deftly dreaming Dexter. When I finally looked up from the computer, night had come, and it was dark outside. And I did what a normal person almost certainly would have done several hours ago. I quit. There was nothing else I could do except wait for Deborah. I would have to let my poor, tormented sister haul me away to jail. After all, one way or another, I was guilty. I really should be locked up. Perhaps I could even share a cell with McHale. He could teach me the rat dance. And with that thought, I did a truly wonderful thing. I fell asleep.
Chapter 24. I had no dreams, no sense of traveling outside my body. I saw no parade of ghostly images or headless, bloodless bodies. No visions of sugar plums danced in my head. There was nothing there, not even me, nothing but a dark and timeless sleep. And yet when the telephone woke me up, I knew that the call was about Deborah, and I knew that she was not coming. My hand was already sweating as I grabbed up the receiver.
"Yes," I said.
This is Captain Matthews," the voice said. "I need to speak to Detective Morgan, please."
"She isn't here," I said, a small part of me sinking from the thought and what it meant.
When did she leave?"
I glanced at the clock instinctively. It was 9:15, and I fell deeper into the sweats. "She was never here," I told the captain.
but she's signed out to your place. She's on duty. She's supposed to be there.
She never got here.
Well, goddamn it, he said. She said you have some evidence we need.
I do, I said, and I hung up the telephone. I did have some evidence. I was terribly sure of that. I just didn't quite know what it was. But I had to figure it out, and I did not think I had a great deal of time. Or, to be more accurate, I did not think Deb had a great deal of time. And again, I was not aware of how I knew this. I did not consciously say to myself, "He has Deborah." No alarming pictures of her impending fate popped into my brain, and I did not have to experience any blinding insights or think, "Gee, Deb should have been here by now. This is unlike her." I simply knew, as I had known when I woke up, that Deb had come for me, and she had not made it. And I knew what that meant. He had her. He had taken her, entirely for my benefit, this I knew. He had been circling closer and closer to me, coming into my apartment, writing small messages with his victims, teasing me with hints and glimpses of what he was doing. And now he was as close as he could get without being in the same room. He had taken Deb, and he was waiting with her, waiting for me. But where? And how long would he wait before he became impatient and started to play without me? And without me, I knew very well who his playmate would be. Deborah. She had turned up at my place dressed for work in her hooker outfit, absolutely gift-wrapped for him. He must have thought it was Christmas. He had her, and she would be his special friend tonight. I did not want to think of her like that, taped and stretched tight and watching slow, awful pieces of herself disappear forever. But that was how it would be. Under other circumstances, it might make a wonderful evening's entertainment, but not with Deborah. I was pretty sure I didn't want that. Didn't want him to do anything permanent and wonderful, not tonight. Later, perhaps, with someone else, when we knew each other a little better, but not now, not with Deborah. And with that thought, of course, everything seemed better. It was just so nice to have that settled. I preferred my sister alive, rather than in small, bloodless sections. Lovely, almost human of me. Now that was settled, what next? I could call Rita, perhaps take in a movie or a walk in the park, or, let's see, maybe, I don't know, save Deborah? Yes, that sounded like fun, but how? I had a few clues, of course. I knew the way he thought. After all, I had been thinking that way myself. And he wanted me to find him. He had been sending that message loud and clear. If I could put all the distracting stupidity out of my head, all the dreams and New Age fairy chasing and everything else, then I was certain that I could arrive at the logical and correct location. He would not have taken Deb unless he thought he had given me everything a clever monster would need to know in order to find him. All right then, clever Dexter. Find him. Track down the Deb-napper. Let your relentless logic slash across the back trail like an icy wolf pack. Kick that giant brain into high gear. Let the wind race across the rocketing synapses of your powerful mind as it speeds to its beautiful, inevitable conclusion. Go, Dexter, go! Dexter? Hello? Is anybody in there? Apparently not. I heard no wind from rocketing synapses. I was as empty as if I had never been. There was no swirl of debilitating emotions, of course, since I didn't have any emotions to swirl, but the result was just as daunting. I was as numb and drained as if I really could feel something. Deborah was gone. She was in terrible danger of becoming a fascinating work of performance art. And her only hope of maintaining any kind of existence, beyond a series of still pictures tacked up on a police lab board, was her battered, brain-dead brother. Poor dog-dumb Dexter, sitting in a chair with his brain running in circles, chasing its tail, howling at the moon. I took a deep breath. Of all the times I had ever needed to be me, this was one of the foremost.
I concentrated very hard and steadied me. And as a small amount of Dexter returned to fill the echo in my brain cavity, I realized just how human and stupid I had become. There was really no great mystery here. In fact, it was patently obvious. My friend had done everything but send a formal invitation reading, "The honor of your presence is requested at the vivisection of your sister, Black Heart optional." But even this small blob of logic was wiped out of my throbbing skull by a new thought that wormed its way in, oozing rotten logic. I had been asleep when Deb disappeared. Could that mean that once again I had done it without knowing it? What if I had already taken Deb apart somewhere, stacked the pieces in some small, cold storage room and... Storage room? Where had that come from? The closed-in feeling. The rightness of the closet at the hockey rink. The cool air blowing across my spine. Why did that matter? Why did I keep coming back to that? Because no matter what else happened, I did. I returned to those same illogical sense memories, and there was no reason for them that I could see. What did it mean? And why did I actually give a single hummingbird's fart what it meant? Because whether it meant something or not, it was all I had to go on. I had to find a place that matched that sense of cool and pressing rightness. There was simply no other way to go. Find the box. And there I would find Deb, too, and find either myself or my not-self. Wasn't that simple? No, it wasn't simple at all. Just simple-minded. It made absolutely no sense to pay any attention to the ghostly secret messages floating up at me from my dreams. Dreams had no existence in reality, left no Freddy Krueger crossover claw marks on our wake-up world. I couldn't very well dash out of the house and drive aimlessly around in a psychic funk. I was a cool and logical being. And so it was, in a cool and logical manner, that I locked my apartment door and strolled to the car. I still had no idea where I was going, but the need to get there quickly had grabbed the reins and whipped me down to the building's parking area where I kept my car. But 20 feet away from my trusty vehicle, I slammed to a stop as though I had run into an invisible wall. The dome light was on. I had certainly not left it on. It had been daylight when I parked, and I could see that the doors were closed tightly. A casual thief would have left the door ajar to avoid the noise from closing it. I approached slowly, not at all sure what I expected to see or whether I really wanted to see it. From 5 feet away, I could see something in the passenger seat. I circled the car carefully and peered down at it, my nerves tingling, and peeked in. And there it was. Barbie again. I was getting quite a collection. This one was dressed in a little sailor hat and a shirt with a bare midriff and tight pink hot pants. In one hand, she clutched a small suitcase that said Cunard on the side. I opened the door and picked up the doll. I pulled the little suitcase from Barbie's hand and popped it open. Some small something fell out and rolled onto the floorboard. I picked it up. It looked an awful lot like Deborah's class ring. On the inside of the band was etched DM, Deborah's initials. I collapsed onto the seat, clutching Barbie in my sweaty hands. I turned her over. I bent her legs. I waved her arms. "And what did you do last night, Dexter?" "Oh, I played with my dolls while a friend chopped up my sister." I did not waste any time wondering how Cruise Line Hooker Barbie had gotten into my car. This was clearly a message. Or a clue? But clues really ought to hint at something, and this one seemed to lead in the wrong direction. Clearly he had Debbie, but Cunard? How did that fit in with tight, cold killing space? I could see no connection. But there was really only one place in Miami where it did fit. I drove up Douglas and turned right through Coconut Grove. I had to slow down to thread my way through the parade of happy imbeciles dancing between the shops and cafes. They all seemed to have far too much time and money and very few clues beyond that, and it took me much longer than it should have to get through them, but it was hard to be too upset, since I didn't actually know where I was going. Onward to somewhere, along Bayfront Drive, over to Brickell, and into downtown. I saw no huge neon signs bedecked with flashing arrows and encouraging words to direct me this way to the dissection. But I drove on, approaching American Airlines Arena and, just beyond, MacArthur Causeway. In the quick glimpse I got on the near side of the arena, I could see the superstructure of a cruise ship in government cut. Not a Cunard Lines ship, of course, but I peered anxiously for some sign. It seemed obvious that I was not actually being directed onto a cruise ship. Too crowded, too many snooping officials. But somewhere nearby, somewhere related, which of course had to mean what? No further clues. I looked hard enough at the cruise ship to melt the poop deck, but Deborah did not spring from the hold and dance down the gangway. I looked some more. Beside the ship, cargo cranes reared up into the night sky like abandoned props from Star Wars. A little farther, and the stacks of cargo boxes were just barely visible in the dark below the cranes, great untidy heaps of them, scattered across the ground as if a gigantic and very bored child had flung out his toy box full of building blocks. Some of the storage boxes were refrigerated, and then beyond these boxes... Back up for just a moment, dear boy. Who was that whispering to me, muttering what soft words to all alone darkly driving Dexter? Who sat behind me now? Whose dry chuckling filled the back seat? And why? What message was rattling into my brainless, echo-empty head? Storage boxes. Some of them refrigerated. But why the storage boxes? What possible reason could I have to be interested in a pile of cold, tightly enclosed spaces? Oh, yes, well, since you put it that way. Could this be the place? The future home of the Dexter's Birthplace Museum? With authentic, lifelike exhibits, including a rare live performance by Dexter's only sister? I yanked my steering wheel hard, cutting off a BMW with a very loud horn. I extended my middle finger, for once driving like the Miami native I was, and accelerated over the causeway. The cruise ship was off to the left. The area with all the boxes was on the right, surrounded by a chain-link fence topped with razor wire. I drove around one time on the access road, wrestling a rising tide of certainty in a swelling chorus of what sounded like college fight songs from the dark passenger. The road dead-ended at a guard booth well before I got to the containers. There was a gate with several uniformed gentlemen lounging about, and no way through without answering some fairly embarrassing questions. "Yes, officer. I wondered if I could come in and look around. You see, I thought it might be a good place for a friend of mine to slice up my sister." I cut through a line of orange cones in the middle of the road, 30 feet from the gate, and turned around, back the way I had come. The cruise ship loomed on the right now. I turned left just before I came to the bridge back to the mainland and drove into a large area with a terminal on one end and a chain-link fence on the other. The fence was gaily decorated with signs that threatened dire punishment to anyone who strayed into the area, signed by U.S. Customs. The fence led back to the main road along a large parking lot, empty at this time of night. I cruised its perimeter slowly, staring at the containers on the far side. These would be from foreign ports, needing to go through customs, access tightly controlled. It would be much too difficult for anyone to get in and out of this area, especially if they were carrying questionable loads of body parts and the like. I would either need to find a different area, or admit that chasing vague feelings, dredged up from a series of taunting dreams and a scantily clad doll, was a waste of time. And the sooner I admitted that, the better my chance of finding Deb. She was not here. There was no reason she should be. At last, a logical thought. I felt better already, and certainly would have been smug about it, if I had not seen a familiar panel truck parked right up against the inside of the fence, parked to display the lettering on the side that said, "Alonzo Brothers."
My private crowd in the basement of my brain sang too loudly for me to hear myself smirk, so I pulled over and parked. The clever boy part of me was knocking on the front door of my brain and calling out, "Hurry, hurry, go, go, go!" But around back, the lizard slithered up to the window and flicked its cautious tongue, and so I sat for a long moment before I finally climbed out of the car. I walked to the fence and stood like a bit part actor in a World War II prison camp movie, my fingers locked in the mesh of the fence, peering hungrily at what lay beyond, only a few impossible yards away. I was sure that there must be a very simple way for a marvelously intelligent creature like me to get in, but it was some indication of the state I was in that I could not seem to fasten one thought onto another. I had to get in, but I could not. And so I stood there clinging to the fence and looking in, knowing full well that everything that mattered was right there, only a few yards away, and I was completely unable to fling my giant brain at the problem and catch a solution as it bounced back. The mind picks some very bad times to take a walk, doesn't it? My backseat alarm clock went off. I had to move away, and right now. I was standing suspiciously in a well-guarded area, and it was night. Any moment one of the guards was certain to take an interest in the handsome young man peering intelligently through the fence. I would have to move on and find some way in as I rolled along in my car. I stepped back from the fence, giving it one last loving look. Right there, where my feet had touched the fence, a break was barely visible. The fence links had been snipped just enough to allow entry for one human being, or even a good copy like me. The flap was pinned in place by the weight of the parked truck so it would not swing out and give itself away. It must have been done recently, this evening, since the truck had arrived. My final invitation. I backed away slowly, feeling an automatic "hello there" kind of absent-minded smile climb up on my face as a disguise. "Hello there, officer. Just out for a walk. Lovely evening for a dismemberment, isn't it?" I cheerfully scuffed over to my car, looking around at nothing but the moon over the water, whistling a happy tune as I climbed in and drove away. No one seemed to be paying any attention whatsoever, except, of course, for the hallelujah chorus in my mind. I nudged my car into a parking place over by the cruise ship office, perhaps 100 yards from my little handmade gate into paradise. A few other cars were scattered nearby. No one would pay any mind to mine. But as I parked, another car slid into the spot next to me, a light blue Chevy, with a woman behind the wheel. I sat still for a moment. So did she. I opened my door and got out. So did Detective LaGuerta.
Chapter 25. I have always been very good at awkward social situations, but I must admit that this one had me stumped. I just didn't know what to say. And for a moment I stared at LaGuerta, and she looked back at me with her eyes unblinking and her fangs slightly exposed, like a predatory feline trying to decide whether to play with you or eat you. I could think of no remark that did not begin with a stammer, and she seemed interested only in watching me. So we simply stood there for a long moment. At last, she broke the ice with a light quip.
"What's in there?" she asked, nodding toward the fence, some 100 yards away.
"Why, detective," I gushed, hoping that she wouldn't notice what she had said, I suppose. "What are you doing here?"
"I followed you. What's in there?"
"In there?" I said. I know, a really dumb remark. But honestly, I had just about run out of the smart ones, and I can't be expected to come up with something good under such circumstances. She cocked her head to one side and poked her tongue out, letting it run along her bottom lip, slowly to the left, right, left, and back into her mouth again. Then she nodded.
"You must think I'm stupid," she said. And, of course, that thought had crossed my mind fleetingly once or twice, but it didn't seem politic to say so.
"But you got to remember," she went on, "I'm a full detective, and this is Miami. How do you think I got that, huh?"
Your looks? I asked, giving her a dashing smile. It never hurts to compliment a woman. She showed me her lovely set of teeth, even brighter in the high-crime lights that lit up the parking area. That's good, she said, and she moved her lips into a strange half-smile that hollowed her cheeks and made her look old. That's the kind of shit I used to fall for when I thought you liked me.
I do like you, detective, I told her, perhaps a little too eagerly. She didn't seem to hear me.
But then you push me on the floor like I'm some kind of pig. And I wonder, what's wrong with me? I got bad breath? And it hits me. It's not me. It's you. There's something wrong about you.
Of course she was right, but it still hurt to hear her say so.
What do you mean?
She shook her head again. Sergeant Doakes wants to kill you, and he doesn't even know why. I should have listened to him. Something is wrong about you, and you're connected to this hooker stuff some way.
Connected? What do you mean?
This time, there was an edge of savage glee to the smile she showed me, and the trace of accent snuck back into her voice. You can save the cute acting for your lawyer, and maybe a judge, 'cause I think I got you now. She looked at me for a long, hard moment, and her dark eyes glittered. She looked as inhuman as I am, and it made a small shiver run across the back of my neck. Had I truly underestimated her? Was she really this good?
And so you followed me?
More teeth.
That's right, yeah, she said. Why are you looking around at the fence? What's in there?
I am sure that, under ordinary circumstances, I would have thought of this before, but I plead duress. It truly didn't occur to me until that very moment. But when it did, it was like a small and painful light flashing on. When did you pick me up? At my house? At what time?
Why do you keep changing the subject? Something's in there, huh?
Detective, please, this could be very important. When and where did you start to follow me? She studied me for a minute, and I began to realize that I had, in fact, underestimated her. There was a great deal more to this woman than political instinct. She really did seem to have something extra. I was still not convinced that any of it was intelligence, but she did have patience, and sometimes that was more important than smarts in her line of work. She was willing to simply wait and watch me and keep repeating her question until she got an answer. And then she would probably ask the same question a few more times, wait and watch some more to see what I would do. Ordinarily, I could outwit her, but I could not possibly outwait her, not tonight. So I put on my best humble face and repeated myself. Please, detective. She stuck her tongue out again, and then finally put it away.
Okay, she said. When your sister was gone for a few hours and no word where, I started to think maybe she's up to something. And I know she can't do anything herself. So where will she go?
She arched an eyebrow at me, then continued in a triumphant tone.
To your place, that's where, to talk with you.
She bobbed her head, pleased with her deductive logic. And so I think about you for a while. How you're always showing up and looking, even when you don't have to. How you figure out those serial killers sometimes. Except this one? And then how you fuck me over with that stupid list. Make me look stupid. Push me on the fucking floor.
Her face looked harder, a little older again for a moment. Then she smiled and went on.
I says something out loud in my office, and Sergeant Doak says, I told you about him, but you don't listen. And all of a sudden, it's your big, handsome face all over the place, and it shouldn't be.
She shrugged. So I went to your place, too.
When? At what time did you notice?
No, she said. But I'm only there like 20 minutes, and then you come out and play with your faggot Barbie doll, and then drive over here.
20 minutes?
So she hadn't been there in time to see who or what had taken Deborah, and quite probably she was telling the truth and had simply followed me to see what?
But why follow me at all?
She shrugged. You're connected to this thing. Maybe you didn't do it. I don't know. But I'm going to find out. And some of what I find is going to stick to you.
What's in there in those boxes? You're going to tell me? Or are we just going to stand here all night?
In her own way, she had put her finger right on it. We could not stand here all night. We could not, I was sure, stand here much longer at all before terrible things happened to Deborah. If they hadn't already happened, we had to go right now, go find him and stop him. But how did I do that with Lagerta along for the ride? I felt like a comet with a tail I didn't want. I took a deep breath. Rita had once taken me to a New Age health awareness workshop, which had stressed the importance of deep cleansing breaths. I took one. I did not feel any cleaner after my breath, but at least it made my brain whirl into brief action, and I realized I would have to do something I had rarely done before, tell the truth. Lagerta was still staring at me, waiting for an answer. "I think the killer is in there," I told Lagerta, "and I think he has Officer Morgan." She watched me for a moment without moving. "Okay," she said at last, "and so you come stand at defense and look in? 'Cause you love your sister so much you want to watch." "Because I wanted to get in. I was looking for a way in through the fence." "Because you forgot that you work for the police?" Well, there it was, of course. She had actually jumped right to the real problem spot, and all by herself, too. I had no good answer for that. This whole business of telling the truth just never seems to work without some kind of awkward unpleasantness. I wanted to be sure before I made a big fuss. She nodded. "Uh-huh, that's really good," she said, "but I tell you what I think. Either you did something bad, or you know about it, and you're either hiding it or you want to find it by yourself." "By myself? Why would I want that?" She shook her head to show how stupid that was. "So you get all the credit, you and that sister of yours. Think I didn't figure that out? I told you, I'm not stupid." "I'm not your slasher, detective," I said, throwing myself on her mercy, and now completely confident that she had even less than I did. "But I think he's in there, in one of the storage boxes." She licked her lips.